Thank you, Steve. So the subject of this panel is broadening the non-cat ILS space. But I did like Andy's reminder that before we draw on the non-cat space, we've got to get the cat space sorted. So this could be a very short panel. But it is a good panel, and we're going to cover quite a broad range of subjects within the non-cat space. So let me introduce the panelists first. So to my immediate right, Jonathan Gray, Chief Underwriting Officer of Paul Re, and formerly Axis Re, I believe. Yes, correct. Then to his right, got Callum O'Rourke from Neuberger Berman. Welcome, Callum, and formerly RMS as well, so yep. Very much an analytical modelling background. Next to him is Fergus Reynolds. Fergus is now at Cedar Trace, head of ILS there. But I've known Fergus for many years, mainly his time at Securus. And right at the end is Sebastian Bamsey, and I've learned this is his first ILS conference.
Indeed.
So welcome, Seb. Seb's got a very similar background to me. He's an ex-banker, JP Morgan, 18 years on the DCM side, debt capital market side, currently a managing director at Howden Capital Markets and Advisory.
Yep.
So welcome, all of you. So our subject matter is broadening non-cat ILS, as I mentioned earlier. It's not a huge part of the ILS space. I was trying to get some stats to work out how big a component of the market it is. And if we ignore mortgages, because that's a very particular part of ILS, and probably medical benefits, there's one regular issuer there. On the cat bond side, there's probably only about 8 issuers that have issued non-cat transactions, about $1 billion. And on the quota share side, there's only 6 issuers, about $2 billion. So in aggregate, we're only talking about issuances to date of about $3 billion. So a very, very small part of whoever's broker's numbers you want to use, we'll use Benfield's $120 billion market. So a very small component. So plenty of room for growth. So what we'll talk about is, I'm going to try and break it down into a couple of areas. And I will ask for questions as we're going along rather than wait till the end, because we'll move in some different directions. But we'll talk about broadening non-cat ILS from the perspective of the protection buyer, the seller of a security initially, then we'll move on from the investor perspective, and then we'll pick up a few related questions at the end. And as we go through each section, as I say, I'll come to the audience or see if there's any interest in the audience to ask any questions. So let's start off with a general question of where we think there is demand for non-cat reinsurance, and what is it the ILS market can satisfy. So who wants to kick that off? Fergus?
Thanks, Des. I think kind of before we start, it's worth trying to say what is the ILS, what's the problem the ILS market's trying to solve in the non-cat space? Because there exists a large traditional kind of specialty reinsurance market, and often ILS structures, as alluded to in the previous panel, add sort of structural complexity and sort of documentational complexity. So non-cat ILS has got to be able to offer something that the traditional market can't really do. So in thinking about that, I think it can kind of add benefit in areas where there's potentially capacity constraints. So that could be in terrorism, it could be in cyber market, where there's a requirement for more capacity than exists in the traditional reinsurance space. ILS can also kind of be helpful when we're thinking about sort of flexibility of capital. So where traditional sort of balance sheets are trying not to get stuck in the curse of kind of permanent capital and want access to flexible capital that they can pull down when an opportunity exists. And the company I work for, kind of Cedar Trace, that's what we've structured with one of our products at the moment, which is called Cedar Trace Diversified, which is a whole account quota share of our sister company, Mireo Insurance's portfolio. And that gives us the ability to pull in kind of capacity beyond Mireo's risk appetite. It also, ILS can kind of be helpful if I'm thinking again from a kind of a demand perspective, where a reinsurer is looking for a revenue stream beyond their underwriting return and investment return, and the fees that they can generate from sponsoring a vehicle ad, kind of a more stable revenue stream than underwriting an investment return. It can also, ILS can also exist if we're thinking within the kind of the Lloyd's framework and the work that Des and others have done in London Bridge in bringing in kind of investors beyond the traditional names and trade capital that has typically supported Lloyd's. So bringing a wider pool of investors to syndicates and managing agents can help kind of improve the stability of their capital provision. And then kind of finally, and I don't want to touch on it too much because it's clearly not my kind of area of expertise, but is the life ILS space. So if we're thinking there, particularly a subset of that, the sort of insurance receivables space, which exists at the kind of intersection between private credit and the insurance market, and that exists to sort of help service some of the smaller insurance companies that have kind of limited access to funds, so from kind of the traditional credit managers that might not have insurance expertise. There exists a sort of subset, and I can see one of my ex-colleagues over there, very successfully put together a life strategy. So while we're thinking about the sort of insurance receivable space, I don't think we should forget about that.
Okay, so are you going to say something?
Just to pick up on that, I think the non-CAT ILS space, it goes back to one of the points on the previous panel, works well for private credit investors who potentially don't have the experience or expertise to come in traditional CAT ILS, which sounds quite scary. As we were saying, that the name catastrophe bond is not intuitive for someone coming into the space. Non-CAT ILS can work quite well for private and credit investors who are looking to find an alternative asset class. And there's so much flowing to private credit at the moment. We're reading it on the newspapers every day. In the traditional asset classes, yields and returns are being compressed in traditional private credit assets, and there's so much competing for that. So actually, non-CAT ILS, for instance, extreme mortality, CAT bonds, if you like, can be an interesting alternative. And we've found at Howden that there are some private credit investors who are willing to do the work to get comfortable with these types of structures, if they can be convinced they are indeed extremely remote, quote unquote, something that you can get comfortable at your IC, get your portfolio manager happy with that concept. It's something they're willing to look at, particularly if you can put a rating on it. If you can get a rating from one of the big three rating agencies, Moody's, S&P or Fitch, and you can call it part of your investment grade private credit strategy, but it's giving you this incremental return because it's got the complexity of an extreme mortality trigger, for instance, that works well with some of these private credit investors. So I think it's an interesting space, this non-CAT ILS, particularly for private credit investors who are looking for something a bit different.
Okay, thanks, Seb. We'll come back to the private credit market and their interest in ILS generally in a moment. But also, Fergus, thank you for the early reference to London Bridge too. That's very, very welcome. So this focus on the buy side, so the protection bias, and we'll try and break it down into two because it's such a broad area of the market in terms of non-CAT ILS, in terms of the traditional market. So we'll break it down in terms of what we might consider to be the relatively short tail classes, and I'll throw in there terror and cyber, and then we'll talk a little bit about what might be more the medium to long tail classes, so the more quota share type structures, because they are a very, very different product. But if we start with the relatively short tail classes, the cat-like classes, so we have seen some successful issuance, and we have some good momentum in cyber, and Paul Ree have done three successful transactions here in the UK, which is encouraging. But from that encouraging start, certainly when I look at the pipeline of what's coming into the cat bond market, the 144A market, there doesn't seem to be a lot of new development in those areas, despite the things we saw last year. Why do you think that is, and what do you think we need to do to sort of reinvigorate the interest in terms of issuance of non-CAT transactions like cyber and terrorism risk? Jonathan.
Well, I can only, excuse me, I can only really speak for ourselves, Des, in terms of, you know, why do we come to market? For us, there are two real things that we're trying to achieve. We want to distance the taxpayer from loss. Ultimately, behind the pool re scheme sits, those of you who are UK taxpayers, sits HMT and the UK government. And the cap bond really forms a very valuable part of building a capital stack that distances the taxpayer from loss. And when we were set up 32 years ago now, the taxpayer was just a few million pounds away from paying terrorism claims here in the UK. Now it's £13 billion away from paying losses here in the UK, which is a very, very good outcome indeed. For us, we're trying to, as I say, on one hand, distance the taxpayer from loss. On the other hand, we want to return risk to the private market. The government is really keen that we end the market failure that broke out in terrorism back in 1992. And for us, we see very much the cat bond market as a great opportunity to draw in a new pool of investors. And, you know, Fergus touched on, you know, one of the reasons, you know, we come to market is not because there's not a great traditional market that exists out there for terror. We've exhausted the terror market that's out there traditionally. We need to find new markets. So for us, it's very much around building momentum, and, you know, we're indicating and pushing that message through to various people that we see at conferences like this. So that's how we're seeing it at the moment, Des.
And we've had one other terror pool issue, haven't we? We had Gary out in France issue. As terror pools, you do have this international community. I mean, do you see interest from other jurisdictions in terms of following the lead that you set and Gary out followed? Or do you see other terror pools thinking about tapping the private markets for catastrophe, or are they well satisfied for either by the traditional markets, or are they very happy to that risk to sit on the government balance sheets? Or what do you see?
So you're referring to IFTRIP, which is a forum for terror pools around the world. Some of you may have been connected to them over the years. And certainly, you know, it was great to see our friends in France come out with Athena earlier this year. You know, that's a start of something to move forward with. And we're seeing a lot of interest across the terror pool space. And terror pools are not all created equally. I mean, we're pretty pure terrorism. A number of our colleagues have got all sorts of different perils other than terrorism sitting inside their structures as well. So there's certainly a lot of interest. It's one of the things that we spend time talking about when we're at that conference. So I wouldn't be at all surprised to see in the next few years, you know, more of our IFTRIP colleagues joining the roster.
Okay. Let's try and broaden it a little bit more to other risk classes. So cyber, we've seen a few cyber transactions, and Callum, I think Newberg or Berman have looked at a few. I don't know if you've invested in a few. When you look at non-property cap, you know, 144A structures, what do you think are some of the challenges from the fund manager perspective? And probably where I'm going to with that question is more around the disclosure, the risk analysis, you know, the quantification of the risk. What's sort of your experience from a fund manager perspective?
Yeah, I guess, you know, comfort around modelling is clearly a factor. It takes time for investors to educate themselves on perils like cyber, like terror, that, you know, sit outside of NatCat. You know, take cyber, for instance, the models themselves are, you know, relatively immature. If you look at the model views of risk as well, they're quite, you know, they're pretty divergent if you look at the EP curves. So it just, you know, adds a general, you know, uncertainty. It was difficult to get comfortable with the modelling. The historical set for cyber, you know, we haven't really had any cyber cat events, so it makes it challenging on one hand to actually build intuition around the model and validate it, but then within the cat bonds themselves, you know, terms and conditions haven't really been stressed for a severe event. Cyber is quite a hard event to define. It's quite amorphous in nature. Also has the potential to be quite long tail. So really, to get comfortable there, you know, you need these events to test war exclusions and you know, event definitions. So yeah, there's still an education piece there. I think linked to modelling, I think correlations, you know, an obvious concern for investors, not just correlation with the broader the potential for positive correlation with the broader financial markets, which, you know, kind of goes against the key tenet of NatCat and how it markets itself, but also specific to cyber. You know, if there is a significant event, the potential for, you know, high intra-bond correlation, that probably puts, you know, a cap or a limit on the number of bonds that can actually be participated in. So, you know, that also probably, you know, puts a bit of dampener on growth.
Yeah, because you don't have those correlation issues with traditional NatCat in terms of...
Yeah, I guess, you know, there's an argument that how far you go into the tail, correlation will start to be there, but and how long that correlation is there for. But, you know, it's optically as well, you know, it's not NatCat, so you've got to communicate that potential correlation effectively.
Okay, and do you see any other risk classes that you think should be more suitable for like a 144A type issuance that we haven't seen come to market?
I think you'd probably touch on a challenge there that, you know, outside of terror and cyber and life, I guess, that fits the kind of cat bond product and you know, risk profile. I'd open it up to other folks, but I don't really see any obvious candidates other than those.
So it's very senior in the tower and average expected losses in the low single digits.
Yeah, for sure.
It's a difficult purchase. And what you see a lot on the traditional side, the cover bought in the other classes, specialty classes, is usually a lot lower down. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the issue about, like, you know, your certainty around loss probability and your alignment with the original underwriter. Okay, let's try and develop this. So that's an interesting positioning for the challenges of non-cat risk on an XL basis, an excess of loss basis for 144A type product. But we are seeing a lot of interesting developments in the quota share product. And there's been a couple of recent announcements about, you know, casualty type ILS quota share structures. And I certainly know from my perspective, from my background in reinsurance broking, you know, a lot of time and effort is being invested by the brokers and the advisors looking at structures that could offer a different type of capacity to cedents for non-cat. And as I said, there have been some notable successes. You know, Ascot's recently done a transaction, RenRe's been in the market for a while, AXIS have done transactions. From your experience, Fergus, what sort of structures do you think work well on a fully collateralized, fully funded basis? And what sort of innovations do you think could unlock the potential for growth in this sort of quota share type proposition?
I think, again, if we're thinking back to what the traditional market offers, which is a kind of untime-bounded promise to pay where the risk is the credit risk of the counterparty, which the traditional market has spent many years getting comfortable with. So I think from the ILS perspective, it's got to be able to offer as close to that as possible in terms of structuring perspective, or at least a mechanism which is kind of equitable in the way that claims liabilities fall back to another party beyond the investor at a certain point in time. So I think it's the structures where, I don't want to be a doom monger, but it's where the worst case scenario is thought about and both parties are comfortable that should that play out, then that they feel that the treatment has been equitable and they understood it. So I do think quota shares are a good solution, but if we're thinking back to within the Lloyd's capital provision, Lloyd's has been dealing with this through the reinsurance to close mechanism for many years, which gives a year of account sort of certainty as to when it's going to close, or if there is an event like COVID that occurs, that a year of account can be kept open for a longer period of time until people are comfortable around the level of reserving, and then it can be sort of close into a future year of account. So I think we're also seeing some other sort of options in the market for people, sort of exit options that people can structure that allow investors to come out should they choose to at a predetermined price.
Yeah, and that always was the big issue with, you know, structuring casualty ILS. You know, how do you give the investor confidence that they can trade out of their position in a reasonable period? And there have been some innovations there with some legacy players offering forward exit solutions.
Yep.
But you've also got this embedded process within the Lloyd's market that, you know, after 3 years of accounts, there is the reinsurance to close process. So Lloyd's, you would think, would be a natural home for that. And I think the other thing, just doing the Lloyd's pitch, is, you know, on behalf of investors, you've got the added comfort of Lloyd's where you've got the corporation overseeing that process. So from I know there was a talk in the earlier panels about fiduciary responsibility and, you know, doing the right thing for the investor rather than the right thing for, you know, who's buying the protection. You know, the corporation fulfills that role. You know, it does hold the managing agent to account for their reserving and for their business planning. So, you know, investors should be able to get comfortable, you know, with that role in terms of when they're looking at the these casualty structures. So did you want to offer any more perspective on what you're seeing from the advisory team's angle in terms of or both non-cat quota share, but probably just broaden it, you touched on it earlier, whole account type structures, stop loss type structures, and sort of different types of investors coming in and sort of liking the asset class, but probably, you know, don't have the appetite for the property cat component of it.
Yeah, and I suppose that's where it shifts into sort of more capital protection for the cedent rather than sort of managing earnings volatility. But, you know, we've seen appetite from very large banks. I think one of them's in the room today, where they're happy to offer that type of protection. And there are more banks who potentially have interest in taking that type of remote insurance risk and being able to find a place for it on their balance sheets. But also, we've been spending a lot of time with, again, private credit investors on this sort of whole account stop loss structure, which we've called ICE Notes, to give it sort of a cool sounding name. It stands for Insurance Capital Enhancement. It doesn't really mean anything, but it's a product which is designed to provide capital relief for the underlying cedent, and it's designed to be, it works a lot like a cat bond, except it has a very remote trigger, sort of a 1% probability of attachment, and it's a very simple trigger. It's the net loss ratio of the underlying cedent on a calendar year basis. So the idea is you have something which is very simple, which is very remote, which a credit investor can get comfortable with, even if they're not an ILS investor or have that sort of ILS expertise. And it's, you know, it's designed to capture all of the underwriting risks of the underlying cedent, including reserve risk. So it only works for cedents who've got a very strong track record, have a very sort of well-respected management team. So it's not for everyone, but there is definitely appetite out there for this type of products. We just need to find the right cedent to put it in place. But it's definitely something that I think has a place in terms of broadening out this non-cat ILS space.
Yeah, and so a lot of what we're talking about now is, like, you know, what's motivating an insurer or reinsurer to issue these types of products. And it's interesting what I think where you were going, which I do totally agree with, is, you know, from the cedent's perspective, you know, the sell side, the protection buyer's perspective, it's not about, you know, raising capital for capital's sake, because that's never going to be successful, and certainly Lloyd's wouldn't sort of countenance someone come to market, you know, just with a load of capital and want to deploy it in the Lloyd's market. But it's about developing the optimum capital structure for the insurer and reinsurer, and certainly you see that a lot where I do think this sector, coming from a banking background, has a very simple capital structure, and that there's a far deeper pool of investors that can optimise your capital structure between what's core for your core business throughout the cycle and what's a little bit more accordion to respond to, you know, peaks and troughs, ebbs and flows of where there is a need and where there are growth opportunities. Would you agree with that? Would you want to comment on that? Or
no, I agree with that, and I think as I mentioned earlier, there is so much money flowing into private credit, and there's such a scarcity of really differentiated assets where they can capture some yield, but at the same time get comfortable with that. This sort of whole account stop loss protection, which is inherently remote, it perhaps is so broad that it's more difficult for the traditional markets to provide that type of protection. Mm. But investors, you know, if a credit investor is willing to provide subordinated capital to an insurance company, they are taking all of the asset side risks, all of the liability side risks, but they get comfortable because it has a rating and it's viewed as a vanilla product. So we're just sort of evolving that into something a bit more structured, a bit more bespoke. It does something slightly different to the balance sheet. It's not increasing available capital, it's reducing the capital requirements. But the types of risks that you're exposed to as an investor are not that different. It's just more of a focused underwriting risk trigger. And again, as long as it can be perceived as quote unquote remote and it's over a short term basis and there's a very strong track record, it's something that's very placeable in the market.
So Fergus, you work within a startup business, you know, relatively new, that took a, you know, there was a lot of work that went into before it got launched. And clearly within that, you were looking at various capital structures. You know, as the team were looking at setting Mireo up and the way the company would be structured, I mean, would you be able to offer any comments in terms of like the different pools of capital that you explored before you came up with the final structure where you are today, or maybe where you want to evolve to in the future?
Well, I don't think I can talk about anything that happened before the 1st of July because that's when I joined. yes, it is. It is. Mireo will be always be looking at how it can optimise its capital base and how it can generate the best returns for its investors. So it would always look at all the different forms of capital provision, stroke risk transfer, to help optimise that.
Yeah.
So if the ICE notes is something that's available, then yes, absolutely, it would be looked at to help. Sort of if that, rather than, as you said, increases the capital, it reduces the capital requirement, which allows us to write more inwards business on the same capital base, then that helps boost the return on equity, then that's probably a benefit.
Yeah, and that's always been one of the challenges I've always offered to the teams that I've been part of, is like, you know, we go out and pitch the ILS product, the Cat 1 product, whatever it is, the sidecar product. But when we're talking to clients, we've got to think about it in the context of what other pools of capital they've got access to, be it the traditional markets or be it the public markets or the private markets, debt or equity, and trying to put, you know, not pitch a product, but trying to get close to the client and see what problem they're trying to solve and where is the most efficient source of capital to service their needs at that time and in the medium
term. Yeah, I think the more levers you have to pull, the better.
Yeah, absolutely. And not only just levers, but also certainly how quickly markets evolve is your ability to adapt to those market opportunities. And part of the strategic rationale why Lloyd sponsored London Bridge is because they were frustrated that when market opportunities arose and there was a need to respond quickly and raise capital quickly, you know, Lloyd's and the UK just weren't responsive enough. And no surprise, you know, Bermuda filled that gap and did it very, very well. And that's part of why London Bridge is in place, is just to provide a UK solution to respond to, you know, change in market conditions and the flow of capital. So let me just pause there for a moment. We're nearly halfway through our session and we've just tried to focus, I know we've moved a little bit on the investor side, but we tried to focus mainly from the sell side, the protection buyer side. Does anyone want to offer any comments or questions? Or should I just crack on? And you're all thinking about lunch by now. Some of you should not be thinking about lunch by now. Some of you should be thinking about going down the gym. But I won't highlight those individuals.
Look at the ceiling, Des.
Look at the ceiling, yeah. Okay, let me crack on then. I'm going to run out of questions, so you might get an early lunch. Let's turn it around to the investor side. And I know Seb, you want to talk about private credit, so I'm going to give you the opportunity now. So what? I don't know, I'm going to go to Callum. I haven't really included you much. So thinking about it from the investor side, you are an investor. Your firm's been allocating to the sector for quite a long while. What from your, and I know you're very big on cat and probably very small on non-cat, but what do you think are the attractions of non-cat to the ILS investor community?
Well, I guess, you know, from 144A, the obvious positive is being growing the opportunity set. The 148 market's grown, you know, over the years, which has been great, but it's been more of a kind of steady march rather than, you know, big jumps. And I think to get the kind of big jumps, you do need to start to expand into other perils, like we said before, like cyber, like terror. And then the other one as well, assuming you're comfortable with all the modelling uncertainties, but there is a diversification benefit to a 144A portfolio, which is going to be very heavy nat cat, that if you add, you know, allocations to terror, to cyber, they're going to be they're going to provide a diversification benefit, assuming that you're happy with the risk adjusted returns and all the modelling uncertainties that we've mentioned already. And then I think as well the other attraction is that, you know, there is a novelty premium, so if you look at the cyber bonds, or there's a potential novelty premium, I should say. If you look at the cyber bonds that were issued at the end of 2023, they all have, you know, attractive outright spreads, you know, even accounting for quite a healthy buffer for modelling uncertainty.
Fergus, did you want to add anything more? I know you talked a little bit about the rationale for CEDA Trades, but, you know, looking back at your experience at Securis, you know, why should a fund manager be looking to explore non-cat, and, you know, what are the real attractions?
I think my sort of most recent kind of experience of working at IQ at Lloyd's Syndicate is relevant, where there is clearly kind of demonstrable skill on the underwriting side in many of the specialty lines of business that are written within the Lloyd's market, some of the very niche lines, where underwriters have kind of superior, like, distribution and access to business. They have unique products, through this they're able to create portfolios of specialty risk that can clearly kind of outperform. I think that to be able to use structures, again, we go back to London Bridge, that can allow kind of institutional investors access to those niche specialty lines, then that's going to be of benefit to the investor community overall.
Yeah, and I think also, and we're beginning to see this outside of Lloyd's as well as inside Lloyd's, I think investors are very interested in structures that offer them access to the risk class and avoid the operational risks of running an insurance business. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the managing agent member structure at Lloyd's plays very well to that, where you can, you know, take some exposure to syndicate risks.
Yep.
And not exposure to the operational risk that might sit in the managing agent, and then have the added comfort of, you know, the corporation overseeing all of that.
And I think another thing that is the Lloyd's is the sort of speed of their kind of ability now to be able to approve new entities, be that syndicates in a box, syndicates, full syndicates themselves. I think, just correct me if I'm wrong, but there was a recent full syndicate that was launched, which was around 10 weeks from first engagement with Lloyd's to kind of approval to underwrite. So I think that's fantastic when Lloyd's themselves are able to provide people with quick access to take advantage of opportunities that exist, because those opportunities might not persist for that long. So to be able to allow people in with sort of clear and good business plan, I think is great.
Yeah. Let's think about the additional disclosure education that's required to move outside of property cat. Seb, you've touched on private credit. I know Hayden do a lot of work with investors and trying to help them think about other opportunities outside of property cat. What sort of your experience of what the market, and it's interesting what Nicola said earlier about some of the disclosure that he gets as a fund manager from private transactions. I know you're mainly talking about property cat, but, you know, you can get from an underwriter that you won't get in a 144A disclosure. What sort of your experience of the sort of things as you go around and talk to the investor community that they find helpful in deciding whether to allocate to risks outside of property cat?
I mean, it's an obvious point, but I think transparency is key, and I think investors, you know, ultimately they're looking for return. That's their job, and they can see sometimes some very attractive returns on offer in these new asset classes, but at the same time they don't want to be the dumb money, if you like, taking on a risk that perhaps the traditional market is unwilling to take. And so have they missed something? Is there some misalignment in the risk that they think they're taking with the risk that they're actually taking? So I think a lot of it is about transparency and engagement with the investors. And when we do work on you know, private credit style deals for insurance companies, you know, the types of diligence that is done is incredibly detailed. You know, that the contents of a virtual data room that the investors have access to is way beyond anything you would see in the public markets. So the investors really do roll up their sleeve and do a lot of work. But then ultimately it comes down to their comfort with the management team and feeling that you know, everything that they should be aware of has been put into that data room, and that they really believe in that management team and they have the right track record. And when things come up, because these processes normally take a period of time, 3 to 6 months, there will be events during that period. How does the company respond to that? How forthcoming are they with their kind of initial loss expectations, or how is this going to impact their earnings or their balance sheet? So I think it's all about sort of active engagement and transparency based on the interactions that we've had with investors.
What about your experience, Jonathan? I mean, educating people on UK terror is not an easy process. It certainly wasn't in Baltic 1. What's it like in Baltic 3?
Well, I think the appetite for sort of understanding terror is extremely strong. I mean, it's a very fascinating class. You know, it affects all our lives. You know, we've come here today to the centre of London, and unbeknownst to us, you know, thousands of people have been working to keep us safe. And it's something that we find investors have huge appetite to understand, really intrigued, I think, as to, you know, we know this risk is out here, but what does it look like? And I can only speak for ourselves and say we really like meeting investors. We love the conversation. We like sharing about the things that we're doing, the things that we know that the security services and the counter-terrorism police are doing. And we find that investors have got a very strong appetite for understanding that. And so for us, it is an easy sell in some respects. And trying to get to, we've been delighted to work with on the journey from 1 to 3, you know, from having our own model to working with another partner to produce some more modelling, now working with Moody's. You know, again, the evolution of modelling within the terror space is something that's definitely picking up. It's picking up pace, and that's something that we know from the engagement that we've had that really matters to investors. You know, they want to see that.
Yeah, and if anyone's interested in getting into the advisory space, I would recommend that you find a client like Paul Reed, because the post-deal dinners are fascinating, because you never know who you're going to sit next to. And you learn a lot about what actually goes on behind the scenes to keep everyone safe, which is really, really interesting. I suppose another reality to non-cat is the margin. There isn't quite the same margin in non-cat as there is in property cat, probably with the exception of cyber, for good reason, Callan. But when you're looking to structure on a fully funded, collateralised basis non-cat, you are dealing with lower risk margins on the underwriting, and investors are looking for returns that are comparable with other assets that they're invested in that they believe has a similar risk profile. So there is a need to probably make the... And they have a longer duration as well, so you've got to bear that in mind. So there is probably the need to generate something more than Treasury's return on the asset side, on the collateral side. How receptive do you think the insurance market is, or even the regulators, let's bring them in, to, you know, allowing collateral assets to go further down the credit curve in terms of both yield and liquidity and market risk? Who wants to pick that up? Fergus?
I think does some of it come down to the sort of the track record of the manager of the insurer getting getting comfortable with the track record, or the regulator getting comfortable with the track record. And it can also come down to sort of how much over collateralization there could be within a vehicle that allows that vehicle to take more investment risk.
You're not going to stop there, are you?
Yes.
Okay. I'll say I'd agree with that. Yeah. Certainly from transactions that we've seen at Lloyd's, it's really about aligning the investment strategy to the underwriting risk exposure.
But we were talking about last night, Des, at dinner, when you're saying that Lloyd's are sort of becoming a little bit more amenable to people having a sort of more active investment strategy within the funds at Lloyd's space.
Well, both capital assets and what I'd call the profit embedded in the premium assets. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, it's more receptive to thinking about what's the underlying exposure of the syndicate and what's the right investment strategy to align with that. And we have teams in Lloyd's now, investment teams, that can assess the quality of the fund manager. They can assess the liquidity and the market risk of the individual assets, and they're not adverse to allowing allocations outside of the standard approach for alternative illiquid asset classes, which is good, because it then gives the investor the opportunity to generate an IRR that's more competitive and more comparable to what they see elsewhere, certainly in the private credit arena. That we see a lot of it in, you touched on life earlier, a lot of the structures you see in the life sector are effectively enhanced yields on traditional credit assets, and then there's no reason why the non-life sector can't explore those. But I think your point is a good one. It's got to be for the right manager with the right mix of investments that are aligned with the risk profile and the cash flow profile or claims profile.
Would Lloyd's then look at the total risk of the vehicle? So if you're taking, if we call risk kind of volatility, if you're taking less risk on the underwriting side, say it's a UK motor portfolio, that Lloyd's allows then more risk to be taken on the investment side to generate a return overall, because ultimately insurance vehicles are often total.
Yeah, I think Lloyd's has always been good at giving diversification credit across the classes of businesses being underwritten, and that, where does that diversification credit sit? It sits in the central fund, and the central fund is built over many, many years by the contribution of members over many, many years. So you've got to be mindful of who's ultimately benefiting from that diversification credit. But Lloyd's, as I said, Lloyd's has the now has the capabilities within house to assess these propositions, and it's been able to attract some good quality books of underwriting, because at its core, Lloyd's is about quality underwriting that's sustainable, but also it's about attract good quality underwriters and good quality investors, and aligning it with Lloyd's strategy, and I think we'll probably see more of that in the not too distant future, which should be good for Lloyd's and be good for the London market actually, and hopefully good for the ILS market as well.
Yeah, grow the pie. We're talking about.
We've talked about pies and we're back to eating again, aren't we?
Yeah.
We've been talking about growing the pie for a long while. Okay, let me pause again there and see if anyone in the audience has got any questions. Everyone puts their head down and thinking about lunch. Okay. So let's move on then. I don't know if we can talk about this for 15 minutes. We're going to try. Nihilus did a good opening this morning about the ambition of the UK market and how the regulator's responding to feedback in trying to make the UK market competitive. Not sure I totally followed the cricket analogy. I'm more of Lucas camp of knowledge of cricket, but I know where it's coming from. Field of Dreams would be a better analogy for me. Understand the ambition, and there's a few in this audience that were involved many, many years ago in thinking about how you can make ULS, how you can bring ILS to the UK market, and has seen how it's had some false starts over the years, and the PRA, given credit, are very, very responsive and want the UK market to be successful. But I've always had a view that Bermuda do a fantastic job Guernsey do a good job, to be honest, and Singapore do an interesting, offer an interesting proposition in their part of the world. So what do you think the UK needs to do to really differentiate itself in the ILS market to persuade issuers who are looking to transfer risk into the ILS market, either in solvency form or in traditional risk transfer form, to actually use the UK market more? So I'm going to turn to you, Jonathan, being a public-private company. What do you think the UK regulators, UK market needs to do more of to bring more business opportunity into this, into London, particularly on the ILS side?
Well, we're proud to be here in London. Baltic 1, Baltic 2, Baltic 3, future Baltics, if they emerge, would be here in London. You know, it's the sensible place for us to be, and delighted to be working with the PRA, who we've always found to be superbly responsive to us as we've gone through those
processes. And that's not just because they're sitting in the
and
audience.
And that's not just because the keynote came from them, or they're sitting there, or the, of course, that they are the PRA. But we've really enjoyed the dialogue that we've got with them. And I mean, I think the thing I would say, because I think what's going to attract investors, I think the gentlemen to my right are going to be able to better talk about it than me as a seller. But I think the thing that I would underline, because I did follow most of the cricket analogies that were there this morning, is that there's a real desire, I think, both within the regulator and within politicians and civil servants, to try and make this as competitive a place as it can be. I think there's a, you know, it doesn't matter what stripe of politician you are here in the UK at the moment, you know, growth is on everybody's mind. It's whether they're subscribing it to it successfully or not, I'll leave for you to judge, but everyone is committed to that. And I think from that point of view, it is placing us in a really good space. And, you know, yes, there's more work to do, and yes, we're here in Britain, and we're mostly denominated in GB pounds, and there's currency issues that exist elsewhere. But I do genuinely believe that we're in a good space here, and we are listening, as I think came out in the keynote earlier on, to the concerns that have been brought in the past. But I'll turn it, I don't know which of the
well,
three
don't know, well,
of
let's,
you
let's go to Callum. Callum, how big an issue is jurisdiction from the fund manager's perspective?
Yeah, I mean, it's more about to the extent it facilitates more deals coming to market and increasing the opportunity set. Like, for us, it can only be a positive thing, right? To see more Baltics be issued in a regulatory environment that encourages that.
Yeah, Fergus?
I'd say it's speed of and responsiveness. I think it's important to be as competitive as other regimes from that perspective.
Yeah, and certainly that's my experience with the London Bridge transaction. Have I used up all my quotes, all my opportunities to promote it? One of the real benefits of London Bridge too is the flexibility we've got to respond to you know, the opportunities that each structure offers. And I think Andy mentioned it earlier, and he's absolutely right, that it's very difficult to go and get authorisation and try and anticipate how every deal is going to look, because each deal is different. But there are certain fundamentals of a deal that you need to satisfy to meet the regulatory requirements, and the permissions we've got with London Bridge focuses on that. So, you know, there are clear requirements that we need to have in the documentation, you know, the reinsurance agreement or the securities document, that need to be satisfied. But outside of that, it's about the commercial terms, and those commercial terms are negotiated between the buyer and the seller, and London Bridge has the ability to respond very, very quickly, providing the mandatory terms are met. And I think that was a game changer for us at Lloyd's, is just having that flexibility, which has enabled us to do the volume of transactions we've done, some of which including new syndicate authorisation. And it wasn't 10 weeks actually, it was closer to 8 weeks than 10 weeks. So, and that responsiveness just like surprises people. Yeah. And you add to that, you know, some of the receptiveness of the executive at Lloyd's to look at new opportunities. And that's why, you know, we have got, you know, a strong pipeline of interest, both from the carrier side and also from the investor side. You're nodding. You're going to say anything? Just nodding.
No, I think just the overall cost is another consideration.
Cost is a big issue. Cost is a big issue, and that's probably where Bermuda does have an advantage because they have such a big industry there, and they can do things far quicker. And we do have a cost issue in the UK that it is a factor that needs to be considered. But the big one of the big sells for the UK is we have some of the best underwriters in the world sitting in this city and not too far away from us. And we have some of the largest and the best alternative asset managers in the world sitting here. So, you know, they don't need to get on a plane quarterly to do board meetings. They can do transactions here in London, and that's a huge benefit.
Absolutely.
As well. Okay, right, we've got 9 minutes left. So, oh, we've got a question. Excellent. Thank you.
Hi. I understand London Bridge is a good bit of kit, a good bit of infrastructure. I've had some conversations that suggest that some investors might like it to be even easier. Is there any benefit in bolting a sort of more standard fund on the front of it? Would that be more attractive to investors or not? Interested to know.
Yeah, so London Bridge is just quite simply a risk transformation vehicle. So it turns a reinsurance agreement into a debt or equity security. So it is a risk transformer. A lot of people have talked to us about setting up specific funds to allocate into the Lloyd's market and build a diversified portfolio of risks at Lloyd's and then selling units and having that transform through London Bridge. You know, that technology exists. I think the big challenge there is, certainly from what I've seen about with people who have tried to go down that route, is providing the end investors who are going to buy these units in this fund the confidence that they're going to get access to the risk profile that's on the pitch book. And also the question of, and it's, you know, it's also about can you deliver on that proposition and in terms of getting access to the risk profile and delivering the returns, because not all syndicates at Lloyd's are receptive to third-party capital, and some of the better performance syndicates are fully aligned and they're very happy with their own capital because they're owned by global insurers and reinsurers, and Lloyd's is a minority part of what they underwrite globally, and they raise their funds globally and then allocates it to their various underwriting operations. But having said that, there are some very, very good independent underwriters at Lloyd's that are very receptive to third-party capital. So it's like finding the right proposition, the right management team to manage that. But in terms of London Bridge, you know, that vehicle can facilitate it. But all it really is, it gets a lot of profile, but it's just simply a risk transformation vehicle that has got some tax benefits and is pretty efficient. And it's got some really good people promoting it as well. Barbara, I knew you was going to ask me a question. You're not allowed to ask a Lloyd's question, by the way.
My question is on ILS and, let's say, the London Bridge, who picks up the tab if things go wrong? Is that the central fund and also all the other products?
Yeah, as you all know, Barbara, most of the members of Lloyd's are limited liability vehicles, and if the syndicates they're supporting performs badly and they exhaust premium and they exhaust the capital in the member, ultimately the central fund will pick that up at the discretion of council. So it's the council's right to decide to pay a claim if the member's assets are exhausted. And we make that very, very clear to institutional investors who are coming in on, and everyone comes in at Lloyd's now on an limited liability basis. So we made it very, very clear in terms of what's the deal at Lloyd's. The deal is you can get access to a very efficient capital structure at Lloyd's, but we will expect you to fund your losses. And if you don't fund your losses, the council will make a decision whether they use the central fund to pay those losses, but you won't operate at Lloyd's again in the future. And that reputational risk, you know, sits comfortably with most fund managers. Most fund managers that we deal with are happy with that trade because they see the benefit of the efficiency of the capital structure at Lloyd's and the opportunity to deploy their capital alongside, and this is an important point, alongside some of the best underwriters in the world. So technically, and the lawyers will agree with me, you're right, ultimately the tail risk sits with the central fund, but it's not a free bet for them.
Thank you.
Pleasure. I knew that question was coming.
Hi, can I just come back to Sebastian on the whole account stop loss?
Sure.
And we've heard a lot about modeling, investors wanting to get comfort with the modeling. Obviously, whole account stop loss, you have a lot of risk in there, you're at reserving. Did I understand you correctly that it's more about the comfort in the management that you're selling to investors than the modeling, or is it a bit of both?
It's a combination of both. You're right that you're capturing all of the risks on the underwriting side, including reserving risk, and most investors would like some sort of independent validation of wherever you set the loss ratio trigger. They want if the company tells them there's 1% probability of hitting it, they want some external party to come and validate that. But that's as far as it goes in terms of the modeling. I think then they are very focused on the track record and the quality of the management team to believe that they're going to do the right thing. They're not going to suddenly increase the risk profile of the business. There's ways that you can adjust the trigger to mitigate for that, but they want to believe that the business is going to continue to perform in the way that it has done, that they're going to be cautious in their approach, and they're not going to suddenly do some artificial reserving to actually trigger the instrument. Because importantly, the cedent will get the benefit up front. They should see an upfront relief in their capital requirements. They don't need to actually trigger it to get the benefit. And it's such a remote set of scenario, you know, combination disasters would have to occur in a single year to get to that point that it would actually be triggered. That sort of moral hazard that the management might do something and artificially increase the reserves is a very theoretical risk. But importantly, to appeal to a broader audience of investors away from the traditional ILS investors, it has to be simple. They're not going to sit, you know, doing their own modeling work. They'll have some independent validation, and then they're going to do more of a credit style underwrite of the company, I would say.
Antonio
Guevara, Bank of England. I would like to hear more about the life ILS segment. I understand the life annuity sidecars have grown from 17 billion in 21 to over 55 billion in 23. I don't know the figures for last year, but mostly that capacity is provided to US markets. Do you foresee that happening in Europe, and how soon will that be a reality?
So I think when we were talking about life ILS, we were talking about more sort of cat bond like structures, like extreme mortality.
Yeah.
Extreme mortality is an example. You're right, this whole private equity sort of funneling money into life and annuities is a huge theme in the US, and it's a great way for private equity firms to capture an asset base which is never going to move away from them. And so, you know, KKR and others have done this very successfully. Whether it will be replicated in the UK, I mean, I think it's starting to happen. We've seen Pension Insurance Corporation recently be acquired by Athora. Brookfield have acquired Just Group. So these are coming under private equity ownership. So in a slightly different format, private equity owners are getting access to these assets. And ultimately, they're asset plays, and it's really all about the asset side. And I think an important distinction with what we've been talking about is, I think, for an investor looking at the insurance sector, the non-life space is attractive because it's uncorrelated to the rest of their portfolio. As soon as you go into traditional life insurance, the biggest risk often is on the asset side, and therefore you're not getting that same level of diversification. So I think in our sort of world, we really need to focus on the uncorrelated aspect of the risk and the underwriting risk, and that's what really should be driving the investor returns.
Thanks, Seb. Good answer. Perfect timing. Thank you for listening and paying attention. tough subject. I was just going to say thank you to the panel and thank you for your attention and enjoy your lunch.